I've been homesick like all week. And I was trying to figure out, like, there didn't appear to be any, I had got a sinus infection, which is a horrible affliction. Have you ever had one of those?
You know, actually the majority of my teenage years and my young adult life was a persistent series of sinus infections.
Yeah, me too. What is that? I have them. I always assumed it was my like bad Jewish sinuses, but I get them all the time. Every time I get sick, so what happens is I get a cold, just a head cold, as you know, like people do. You get sick, you get a head cold, you get better a few days later. No big deal. I brush it off. And then about maybe 3 days later, I start to get sick again. And yep. Then it spirals out of control to where it's like, I have like crazy pressure in my head. Like I can't, you know, it's just like painful and you can't think. And like, yep. I get like inner ear, you get like dizzy from like your inner ear pressure being all weird. And, just like migraines and fever. It's a horrible, horrible affliction to just have all the time.
So I'm going to tell you now, have you always lived in Chicago?
Yes. Well, you know, I lived in Baltimore for a while and I got sinus infections there too.
Okay. Now I don't know if you do anything preventative wise. I'm going to give you the advice that got given to me for like ages, like literally decades. And, you know, and I ignored and I ignored and I ignored, and then I started doing it. And I'm like, and everything got better. And I'm like,
hope it's not eat well and exercise.
No, it's like, Max, it's Hamilton. You need to listen to Hamilton more just on a constant loop, you know, just pipe it into your house, inject it into your veins.
Cure is worse than the disease.
It's language is a virus, Max. And Hamilton is a beneficent virus. Have you ever seen a neti pot?
Yeah. Well, here's the whole. Okay, go. Explain to our listeners. Sorry, this is terrible. Podcast conversation technique. Please, Pat. I would love if you told me what a neti pot is.
Now, you know, in this culture, although you know, amongst the hippies, you know, or you know, certain people that have already been exposed to it, it's very commonplace, but you know, it's kind of a weird concept. It's a nasal irrigation system, right? That almost makes it sound like scientific or agricultural, but it's like a little teapot, except you put it up your nose and then you pour hot water into your sinuses. It's got like a long, long tradition. It comes, you know, it comes from the East, Max. It's mystical in that regard. I mean, seriously, where it really comes from is like, if you live in a place like Hong Kong or these places with a lot of air pollution, it's the only way that you like don't rot from the inside, because you breathe through your nose and your nose is a big filtration system. And if you're like us and your sinuses are maybe a little narrow, or you're just predisposed towards having these problems, it like, yeah. And let's not pussyfoot around this. Let's talk about mucus, right? When you get a cold, you get mucus, you know? And if you've got a certain type of sinus, it backs up in there, and then you get problems, like really serious problems, with side effects that I will not go into in graphic detail because we don't need that in the podcast, but you use this neti pot and it just sluices you clean. It sluices you clean. All right. You need neti pot to sponsor this. It sluices you clean.
So for many, many, many years, I've been going to, you know, it's like I get sick and I get the sun and I get better and I get the sinus infection. And I know at this point, I know all the signs of, I have the sinus pressure and my mucus, my snot is like a neon, a 90s trading card neon green, just like it's like some sort of like Ghostbusters Ecto Cooler product.
It's
placement.
Like a yellow highlighter. Yeah,
it's really truly gross. So I know at this point I'm like, all right, I got a sinus infection, and there appears to be some debate on the topic. But for me, if I get a sinus infection and I take antibiotics, it gets better in about 72 hours. And if I don't take antibiotics, it does not get better. So I go get the antibiotics and, you know, I'm contributing to the gradual decline of the efficacy of antibiotics and the terrible consequences that will ensue probably within my lifetime.
A little bit. Now, just out of curiosity, which antibiotic?
I don't know. I'm on these like crazy horse pills. They're like the size of my thumb. Like I have to choke this thing down. It's a huge...
Is it a three a day?
Two a day.
That might be doxycycline or amoxicillin.
I think, yeah, it's amoxicillin is the one I have. Yeah. So, yeah. I've been on it for like 3-4 days and I have a big improvement. So, you know, it's like, I do think it's important, but also I know it's terrible for me. You shouldn't take antibiotics. Like, you know, I'm probably taking them an average of once a year or maybe twice a year. And I know that's very bad for you.
It does goof up your, I mean, just the term anti, like bio, you know, it kills microbes, and like a ton of your body is made of microbes.
I'm taking a probiotic and just like over the, you know, really over the counter. Supposedly that's like good, like helps your like good gut bacteria work. Listen, maybe one of our listeners, I'm so skeptical, like taking the antibiotic and the probiotic at the same time. It sounds crazy. My doctor recommended I do it. He's like, take a probiotic and eat a lot of yogurt and kimchi, which I'm trying to do. I don't know. Maybe one of our listeners knows if that stuff works.
Some scientist will come in and, you know, and he'll be like, don't let the antibiotic and the probiotic touch.
I feel like it's like running a humidifier and a dehumidifier in the same room and like trying to let them fight it out. Like, well, we'll see which one of you wins. With regards to the neti pot, for many years, I've been going to doctors to get my antibiotics, and they're like, you should try the neti pot. And I'm like, get out of here with that. Like, I'm paying you for medical advice, not, right. You know, that's like saying, like, you should be more spiritual or something. It's like, I don't want to hear that from my doctor. Like, get out of here with that. But I had someone, I think when I was in college, I had a doctor who, you know, convinced me to give it a try and gave me, so the product that I use, it's not actually a neti pot. It's a related product called like a nasal irrigation or a nasal wash, which the only difference is rather than letting it like drip into your sinuses or your nose, you like blast it up there. You like squeeze this bottle and it like blasts it clean. And you have to use this like salt water, these like packets of like salt that you mix with the water so it doesn't hurt to blast it up your nose. And I use that. It's really incredibly unpleasant. I've never been waterboarded, but I imagine that it's a little bit like waterboarding yourself.
Yeah, there's our product placement. It's a little bit like waterboarding.
Yeah, and it's like, it's one of those things of like, I honestly cannot tell if it helps or not. It may just be that the using the sinus irrigation thing is just so unpleasant that afterwards the baseline misery of having the sinus infection feels better in comparison. But so I can't really tell. But I do think I get fewer. So I use this thing with somewhat regular, like, you know, usage, and I do seem to be getting less sinus infections. So I think there's something to it.
I will say just again for the science of it, when you say fairly regularly or fairly regular use, are you saying
I'll use it like once or twice a week, or if I get sick, if I have allergies or I get sick, I start doing the sinus rinse like twice a day, just as like a prophylactic, like maybe this will prevent a sinus infection. And it seems to work sometimes. Like sometimes when I would normally expect that I would, you know, get sick and then get sick again with a sinus infection, if I'm doing the nasal irrigation, I do not get sick again.
Yeah. And you hit on one of the big ones for me. It used to be like, you know, spring would roll around and there was a lot of pollen, because I'm allergic to like every damn thing in God's creation. And it doesn't necessarily have seasons for me, because, you know, in the spring it's the pollen, and in the summer it's the ragweed, and in the fall it's the leaf mold, and in the winter it's the dust. And so, you know, it's like I don't tend to experience, like, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, my hay fever is killing me. And I'm like, must be nice to have three seasons out of the year when that's not happening in your head. I will. I've never tried this.
So I have a product. I have a product recommendation for our listeners and for you. So here's the deal with this. So, and you should know this for the neti pot too. Any sort of water that you're putting up your nose, it has to be specially filtered water. It has to be micro filtered water with a filter that's like some specification of filter of like 0.02 microns or something like that. And the reason is in municipal, like regular old tap water, there can be single celled organisms, little amoebas in the water that if you drink them or shower with them or whatever, they're perfectly harmless. But if you spray it up your nose, it can get into your brain and kill you.
Now you're fucking with me.
I'm not fucking with you. I am 100% serious.
Okay. Hold on. I'm going to brain killing amoeba
and put neti pot in there.
Brain killing amoeba neti pot. Okay. Oh fuck. Okay. Yeah, you're right. It's the top one is the CDC website. So yeah, I'm not even gonna bullshit around with you on this.
So now it's like, so now I think clearly you've been doing this for a lot. You've blasted a lot of water up your nose and you haven't gotten a brain amoeba that's killed you yet. So it's clearly like the risk is not, it's not 100% chance that it's gonna happen, but also like, of all the risks I'm going to take with my life, like what a way to go! Like, yeah, he was using a neti pot and he got an amoeba in his brain that killed him. Like,
maybe that's why book three has been taking so long. That's going to be my new excuse for a while. It's like, oh, I'm sorry, brain amoeba.
Yeah, I blasted myself in the nose with tap water, and you get the amoeba in the brain. For a long time, what I would do is I would I would order on Amazon gallons of distilled water, because then you're basically paying Amazon to like carry this heavy water to your door for you. And I felt like such a piece of shit doing that. And also like you're buying this expensive special water just to like blast it up your nose, which is silly. but now there's a new product. So this is my product recommendation. It is made by the Sinew Cleanse Corporation. Which, and you can find them at Sinew, S-I-N-U, Cleanse, C-L-E-A-N-S-E.com, SinewCleanse.com. I believe they also carry these products in CVS, which is where I found this. And basically what it is like, it's like a little handheld thing, and it's got like a little water reservoir where you put the water in the salt packet to blast it up, you mix it together and blast it up your nose. And then in the cap, it has the filter. So you can use tap water again, and it actually has a filter built into it, and you can blast it right up your nose. And this has made it so much easier to blast myself in the nose. So I recommend the Sinew Cleanse brand microfiltered nasal wash system. It's a whole system, mind you. I think it comes with like the salt packets and everything. And it's $13.99.
I have to say, Max, if I never hear you say blast myself in the nose again, it will be too soon. but I also want to chime in here. Have you actually tried just a straight up neti pot?
You know what it is? It's like, I feel like this is doing something. You know, the neti pot is like, that's true.
Neti
pot's a bunch of bullshit. It's a little teapot and you put it up your nose. And I can't get into that. This is like a medical device. You know, there's a guy in a lab coat on their website, for God's sake.
No, I think what we have here, Max, is the fundamental difference between Eastern and Western medicine, where here's some people, it's like, you know, hey, here's some water. Maybe if you take some salty water and maybe just kind of pour it up your nose and then it'll kind of come out again. Maybe that would help. And Western science is like, super ultra mega nasal blast, you know? Yeah.
You mix in your packet. It's a pre-packaged disposable little packet of pH balanced, like, you know, salt solution. So already I'm into it because there's chemicals involved. You mix it up in the water and you blast it right up there. You clear the whole system out. It's like a Roto-Rooter. You just wind that thing up and let it go.
But you yourself have described this as an excruciatory process. I will say, because here's my process, right? I get up in the morning, I take a shower, and I apologize, right? This is radio, effectively, which means we've got a lot of imagination happening here. So for everyone that just pictured me in the shower, I really apologize for that. We should have some sort of warning on this episode next. And, but, you know, I have the neti pot in the shower. And I put some salt in it, which I would like to mention that I do not measure in any way. I kind of eyeball it, put some salt in there, and then I take the hot shower water, you know, and I
it's
do that.
It's teeming with amoebas.
Teeming. Like it's, I bet you it's 80% amoeba. such a gross image. Just the sludge coming out of my shower. You know, and it says hot water. And I just kind of, you know, I sluice, right? I'm not blasting anything. There's no blasting happening.
Does it come out the other side? Do you go in one nostril and out the other?
Uh-huh.
See, maybe that's the issue for me is like, I'm too blocked. Just on a good day, I'm too blocked up in there. Like nothing goes through.
And I will, you know, here's the thing that, God, everyone, you're really learning really intimate details.
Well, I think that's why people listen.
But yeah, this is really.
I think
what
they want to know about New York Times bestselling author Patrick Rothfuss's, you know, his nasal passages. I think that's the appeal.
When everybody Googles nasal passage, they thought I was talking about a passage of the book.
Yeah.
really going to get fucked up. You know, and the same's true with me. Like, if I am really congested, if I'm having a bad cold, you know, it'll be hard to go all the way through. You know, you tilt your head on the side, you pour it in one nostril, it comes out the other. But not again, not always really quick and not always really easy. But here's the thing, you know, once it starts going through it, because again, I do this, it's hot water, it's salty, and it causes your sinus membranes, these mucous membranes, to kind of constrict. It gets rid of some of the mucus, and slowly it that's the whole point, is it clears these out. And you know, and then it gets better and better, and then I tip over and I do the other side, and sometimes it works better one way than the other. But the other thing is, you know, this maybe takes a minute, maybe two, you know. And
who has that kind of time in their day?
What's that?
Who has that kind of time in their day?
But I, you know, it's, I do it every day. And so it's much more maintenance. Well, and here's the thing. I don't do it every day, but if you can hear me right now, you can hear that, like, I'm a little congested. I you know, but the truth is my voice probably doesn't sound very different to a lot of people because I'm usually fairly congested, but
now here's the Western medicine way, right? So I wait until the situation becomes medically until I'm so miserable that it's medically relevant, and then I take an extreme corrective action the other way that's way too much. So here's what you do is you load this thing up with your packets of your salt. And you put it up into your nose and you just let it rip. You just squeeze it and it blasts you right in the nose. And it's like, have you ever seen a movie? Have you ever seen a movie where the astronauts are in space and something, the door gets blown off and someone gets sucked out and there's an explosive decompression and their head gets splatters in the helmet? That's how it feels. It's like, so here's what happens. First of all, just your entire nasal passage in your nose just filled with water and you feel like you're drowning and you can't breathe. And it starts like leaking. It'll start dripping down your throat, the salt water. Sometimes, and then both of your ears pop because your head pressure, it's so intense. And then sometimes you'll get, my eyes will tear up and sometimes the salt water will sometimes like come out of my eye ducts.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Yeah. And then afterwards you're sort of like sputtering and coughing and you're like, that, thank you, medicine.
I almost can't process. It's sort of like, you know, we're talking and you're like, well, you know, and then I do this thing and then, you know, sometimes, you know, I shit myself inside out and then I vomit blood, but you know, it's only once a week.
It's like the Iron Islands in the Game of Thrones books. It's like you blast yourself in the nose and then you go, who is dead may never die.
So, you know, Max, especially compared to that, as somebody who meditates, right? As mm-hmm. somebody who, you know, studies Buddhism, right? You know, like, this is sort of, you know, this is a moment in which this minute out of my day, this perhaps 2 minutes out of my day, first off, is in no way excruciatory. Mm-hmm. Second off, it's sort of meditative. It gives me an opportunity to contemplate things. as I wait for this hot, salty water to kind of gently, you know, sluice at this point, I feel like almost is not a comparably gentle enough word for to counterpoint what you've just described. You know, I think at this point, next week's challenge, or not our challenge, but, you know, I think we really owe it to each other to try the other person's way.
Oh, no, no doubt. We've got to do this.
Well, you're kind of getting the I think the good version of this week's.
I don't know, because I got to buy some bullshit little pot.
I've got to blast myself in the nose, Max.
No, it's great. It feels great. It's great. It's like sometimes you just want it. Sometimes you feel bad and you're just like, this head needs to get explosively decompressed. So Veronica and I live in a neighborhood in Chicago called Bucktown, which has become, in my lifetime, it's gone from a neighborhood that was like slightly too dangerous to hang out in when I was like a very young kid to the trendy artist neighborhood when I was in like high school that was like really cool and culturally relevant, to now the current phase in the lifespan. You know, it's like a star where now it's like a red giant and it's in like the latter, you know, days of its like cultural relevance. And now in my neighborhood in Bucktown, there's two competing fancy soap store brand stores. And Veronica and I go walking, you know, we go out to breakfast or whatever, and we walk, and we both have a preference of between these two stores of what fancy soap store to buy. So the soap brands, I'm curious if any of these have reached you in Stevens Point. You don't strike me as a fancy soap man.
Well, you know, actually, you know, it's a badly hidden secret, especially after Slow Regard came out.
Mm-hmm.
I do have a particular weakness for artisanal soaps.
I mean, listen, I'll cop to this. Like, I love a fancy soap.
I'm into the fancy soaps. I will also admit to it.
So basically, so here's the two stores. So the store that Veronica likes is called, it's a brand called Lush. So first of all, you can smell the Lush from a mile away, and it smells it smells like a like potpourri, or it's just like, it's sort of like in not, an unplaceable fruity attack in your, on your senses. And so you come into the store, people are lured into the store like hummingbirds. They smell the nectar with their proboscis. And you go into the store and it's all set up like an organic foods grocery store. So all the soap is on like butcher paper, stacked up in food-like sort of pyramids, and the gimmick of every soap is that it has some sort of organic, like this soap is made from like organic pomegranates, and it's like you put, or it's like a shampoo made from apricots, and it's like everyone knows the magic of the restorative properties of the apricot. And then when they package it up, it gets wrapped up in a little piece of butcher paper and they put it on a food scale and they do it by weight. And it's very, to me, they're very much, what they're selling you is this fantasy of food, of soap as organic food, which is this sort of liberal, it involves these like liberal fantasies about purity and health, and that you can, you know, the same way that conservatives have these crazy fantasies about purity of thought, of like, oh well, if you don't use bad words and you don't have bad thoughts, you can be like a pure good person. Liberals have these, they're crazy on the other side of that scale of like, they have their own purity mythology where it's like, well, if you just eat organic food and you like know the name of your farmer, you could keep all the toxins out and be morally good in that way. And it's all crazy. It all plays off of some sort of like crazy psychological, you know, purity fallacy that people buy into. But Lush is selling you, you know, that's why you're paying, you know, I don't know, whatever, $20 for a fancy soap at Lush, is they're selling you this story and this fantasy of like, oh, it's the soap fresh off the soap farm, and you know, it has all of the restorative pure properties of organic food.
And you know, that's a really good point about the you know, the myth of these purities. That's cool. And by the way, I think I've been, as you describe it, I'm like, well, I think when I was in London, I went into, if not this store, then one so close that it's identical. And yeah, I bought soap there.
The other, Lush is also famous for, I believe they popularized the idea of the bath bomb. And I encountered this because sometimes I'll go in the bathroom after Veronica's taken a bath, and in the bathtub, it's just like crazy like glitter and like pigments, and it looks like a clown killed himself in the bathtub. Like, it's just like, it's just madness. And it's like, what it is it's this like colorful soap ball that you like huck into the bath, and it foams up and boils and bleeds into the bath like some sort of H.P. Lovecraft demon.
Right. And they cost like $15, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Just to let everyone out there know, right? You can get really the same, if not the better effect with like 3 packages of chicken ramen. You know, and you know, the salt is really good for your skin. The MSG is a little tingly. You know, if you're pale, like most geeks are, here in the Midwest, then, you know, the orange coloring, if you're using chicken ramen, as you should, it tans you a little bit, you know, not to a Trump degree, but, you know, it gives you a little color, which is nice. Then if you're bored in the bathtub, you can just, you know, eat the noodles.
Yeah. You throw the ramen brick right in there.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's part of it.
That's a time of savings as well.
Uh-huh. Huge. I mean,
that's a true life hack.
Yeah. Life hack.
So that's store number one. That's the store that Veronica likes. Now, the competing fancy soap store in the neighborhood that I like is called Aesop, and they're the newcomer. They're like the rebellious like bad boy soap store that just moved in. So Aesop is, as far as I can tell, they're maybe like a German or sort of competitor, and the store, it's everything is like clean. The only thing in the store are on the walls. There's like floor to ceiling like shelves with all their soaps stocked in a very attractive array, and then in the middle of the store there is one single table with a sink for you to go in and wash your hands to try their soaps. And I'm like, a store where you walk in and wash your hands, like, yes please, like, I love this. And Aesop's, their whole gimmick is all the soaps come in these little glass jars, and they're all like tinctures and chemicals, and it's very scientific. Everything is like these like precise like mixtures of the right balance of soap for different skin types and things like that. And I'm like, this is my kind of fantasy, because what they're selling me is the fantasy of, for the same $20 you could spend at Lush to get a bunch of like, you know, pomegranate seeds or whatever in your soap, it's like, no, here we've used the miracle of science to like engineer our way into cleanliness. And that's my style.
You know, Max, I really, first, when you started describing this place and you said the sink was in the middle, and I'm like, wow, this, it just, the design of the store, I'm like, this was a psychological trap built for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I was getting ready to engage in a little good-natured ribbing, you know, like, you know, this is one of the foundation stones of our relationship. And then you said little glass bottles, and which I have a particular, they're my kryptonite, you know, like I've got a problem with little bottles. And as you describe this process, I'm like, I want this in my life. You know, I still want to mock because that's just who I am, but I can't, it's like, I've swung around completely, and it's like, I want to visit this store now.
I'm crazy about this. The only thing that went wrong was the first time when they first opened, you know, the first time we went in there, I was like, I tried, you know, I washed my hands with like 20 different soaps, and I was like, I love all of these. And I got my little tinctures and my bottles, and I went up to the register with like an armful of soaps. And they rang it up, and they were like, that will be $100 of soap. And I was like, and at that point I was like, I have drastically overcommitted to this soap-based lifestyle. But I was too proud to be like, I've made a huge mistake, and I need to put, you know, I need to put 80% of this back. So I just have like a different Aesop soap bottle in like, you know, every room of the house just in case.
Here's maybe the third option, right? Which is because both of these are, at least I'm guessing, unless Aesop, you know, with a name like Aesop, this has got to be a chain, right? That doesn't happen.
No, it's a chain. I know they're in like they're in like New York and LA and all that.
So here's the third point of this triangle, right? You know, and I kind of joked when I said artisanal soaps, right? But I'm going to take it a step farther, right? Bespoke soap, right? Where like I like to buy my soap. Like I go to, there's a local energy fair, you know, and different vendors come, and there's a couple of people around here that actually make their own soap, and not the way that I would do it, you know, which is sort of like, I'm, you know, I'm have a hobby, you know, and it's just awful, you know.
Mm.
But like these people really do it. And there was this woman, I wish, like I kept seeing her at these things and I kept buying like just so much soap, but she was into it. She was, you know, and I use this term very specifically. She was a geek for soap, which means she was passionate beyond reason on a subject of her choice. And that's what I think the true division between geek and not geek is if you are a geek for anything, you probably have more in common with all other geeks than you do with non-geeks. But it doesn't matter what you're a geek for. Traditionally, a lot of the areas that are recognized for geekery are like comic books or science fiction fantasy, you know, books or cult movies or stuff. But the truth is, you can be like a baby geek or a model train geek or a stamp collector geek or a soap geek. And so, you know, I kind of picked up a soap and like, I'm just kind of wandering into it. And I'm like, oh, I want to see how it smells. And I pick it up and I'm like, oh, this is interesting. And I smell it. And she goes, well, that one really isn't for smelling, you know? And I look at it and she explains that what that is it's, you know, it's got these particular oils in it, and it's meant to like moisturize skin for people that have like super dry skin. And she goes, a lot of the essential oils, they can be irritants. She goes, this soap is meant to be hypoallergenic, and it has these particular types of oils for the people with skin like that. And I'm like, oh, wow, that's cool. And then I see one, and it says mosquito repellent. And so I pick that up. I'm like, okay, this is going to have like cedar or citronella or something in it. But I pick it up and it doesn't like reek like bug spray. And she goes, oh, that one. She goes, I mix clay in with that. She goes, there's a particular kind of clay. And when you wash with this in the morning, the clay kind of actually coats your skin a little bit. And the mosquitoes, you know, don't like dealing with that.
Come on.
Yeah. And I'm like, and part of me is like, really? But at the same time, it's like this woman has gone like deep, you know, deep down the rabbit hole. And I'm not talking about like tinfoil hat bullshit. It's like this woman we talked for like an hour about like saponification, but that's like saponification is like just, it's for bitches. Like that's where
I don't even know. Wait, I don't even know what is for bitch. What?
Saponification is the process through which, like if you're making soap, you end up with, you start with fat. You know, this is basic Fight Club stuff. You start with fat, you introduce an acid, and then the fat saponifies and becomes soap. But like that's just the basic chemistry that produces soap. Where she's saying, you know, she's what she was is she was kind of a designer. She was saying, what is it that you want your soap to accomplish? You know, if you want an anti-mosquito soap, it's not necessarily that you want to keep mosquitoes away, which soap can't do. It's that you don't want to get bit. And so she did research into like the things that would keep bugs from biting you. And then she designed that soap. She's like, a lot of people are worried about their skin. And then she's like, you know, it's not enough to use good oils. I also have to avoid using things like essential oils that are going to irritate the skin and dry things out. So like that's, you know, I wish I knew where that woman was, or if she was still doing her thing. I bought so much of her soap that even like 6-7 years later, there are still a couple of cakes of it laying around my house tucked in cupboards.
This is blowing my mind. I didn't know you could be a nerd about soap.
I think, well, not a nerd.
I didn't know that you could be a geek about soap more than I am.
We did like Ari's soap. Did I ever show you that?
Oh, wait. Yeah, I think I did see that actually.
We did that for the Indiegogo, and we did that through Black Phoenix Alchemy. And they do like their focus is on scents. They're geeks for smells. But they're not geeks for soap. Soap is just sort of a vehicle for that. So they outsource their soaps, but they did like this beautiful soap for the first Ari book. And then they did a second one for this year's fundraiser. They also did perfumes for like Bast and Kvothe and Denna based on their descriptions in the books. The Black Phoenix people, have you ever bumped into them?
No.
Oh, and I say this with love, and I say it as a compliment. They are fucking crazy. They're my kind of crazy. They make these perfumes, but they make these perfumes like sort of like you hear that somebody made it, and they're like, and you're like, who would do that? Like who would make it? Because who would buy it? They made like soaps for people that played D&D, or not soaps, but scents. And so like, you know how some people will play music, like you're playing a game and they bring up like atmospheric music.
Mm-hmm.
They'd be like, here's a smell for your game. They made like Graveyard.
You know, my friend Ben, who's one of the co-creators of Cards, one of my oldest friends, he is very into scent and smell as like a conduit to emotion and memory. And for Ben, like a lot of his favorite childhood and sort of young adult memory is centered around, you know, video games. Like, and there is a special thrill of that, especially like I think when you're like, you know, a young single nerd in like middle school or high school, and like the new game comes out that you're excited about, you know, Diablo 2 comes out or whatever. And it's like you can turn the game on and play for an entire weekend and not do anything, but you just completely immerse yourself in that game and lose yourself in it. There is a kind of like blissful happiness in that. And Ben, what he would do is he would pick a scent out, like a scented candle, and associate it with a new game when he would go really deep into a game. And then at a later date, when he was feeling, you know, bummed out or he was having a bad day or whatever, he could light up that scent and it would all come rushing back to him, that initial happiness of having played that game.
That is really cool. That's a cool, like almost, I want to call it a trigger or a trick that you could use to, you know, effectively that you could use to bring joy into your life at a later time. You know, it's almost, you know what, that's super clever. That's stored memory is what that is.
I mean, a little bit, right? It's like, or it's more than the memory. It's an emotional state that the memory is related to.
Because, and they've shown that like smells carry that emotional contact, and they're a memory hook, like far more intense than just thinking about something or, that's really clever.
So now here's a new twist on this, which is something I've played with a little bit, which is sometimes when I am working on a project, I will have like a scented candle on my desk. This is, you know, when I'm working on something at home. And when I sit down to work for a few hours, I'll light the candle. And then when I'm done working, I put the candle out. And the next time I'm like, man, I really need to work on that project, I can't say like it's like been like super successful, but I'm sort of like interested in experimenting on this of like, well, maybe if I can sort of condition myself to like light that candle and then be like, oh, I suddenly remember what is fun and interesting and emotionally resonant about doing this work.
That's pretty clever. I wonder if I've done something similar accidentally with eucalyptus. Because, you know, and again, this actually, watch me bring it full circle purely through accident. Because if you tend to be a kind of a chronically congested sort of person, eventually you start trying to find ways to make it feel like your head isn't packed full of hot sand. Eucalyptus, you know, effectively, what's it called? It's like a,
like those nasal spray, like those steroids, like an Afrin.
Yeah. Like I've heard of Afrin, and I'm thinking if I started to use it,
it's highly addictive in the sense of like, if you use it regularly, your like sinuses and your nasal passage will like always be inflamed without it. So people get quote unquote addicted to it in that they need it just to establish like a baseline ability to breathe.
Yeah. See, I'm thinking if I, rather than start down that road, I should probably just, if I were going to do that instead, I would probably just start using cocaine instead.
So here, so this is a whole other side of this, but this is the other thing I do is to, in terms of the allergies and all that, is I take a Claritin D every day. And the Claritin D is the one, it's not prescription, it's over the counter, but it's the one where you have to like show your driver's license to the pharmacist to get it because it has the Sudafed in it. And I
did not know there was that version of, because
I mean, all it is a Claritin with Sudafed in it, but it's just, I just like that I can take one pill and be done with it. Now, I take a Claritin D every day of my life, and I'm basically just taking a little bit of meth every day. I mean, the ephedrine is basically like a low, it's, you know, the Sudafed is, I understand it to be basically a low dose of meth. And let me tell you, there appear to be no negative repercussions in my life for taking a small amount of a stimulant every day, and I fucking love it. I get a Claritin D, I get a little coffee going in the morning. Ooh, I'm in the zone.
You know, Max, once again, we find that we're living parallel lives because, I've bought so much Sudafed that I am at this point certain that I'm on some sort of FBI watch list.
Do you have buyers? Like sometimes I'll have Veronica and I will both go to the Walgreens together and she'll wait in line. She'll like enter a minute behind me, you know, and like stand in line and get the Sudafed after I get it. I have like a whole, it's like at this point, it's like a conspiracy, like a ring.
Do you stockpile it because you're worried about running out?
Oh yeah.
That's classic addict behavior, you realize.
Well, I could stop whenever I want.
Well, I can't.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't need it. It's just that I feel very bad if I don't take it, and I feel incredible when I do. So as I was getting sick, I plowed through the latest season of Orange is the New Black, which is my favorite show on TV. I really think it's the best drama on TV right now. It's an absolutely incredible show. It had a bit of a bumpy third season last year, but this year, the fourth season, one episode better than the next. I mean, one of the strongest ensemble casts like ever on TV, some of the best writing. It's just, it's an incredible television achievement. I love, love, love the show. And this season, for no apparent reason, in the middle of the season, there's a scene where a guard is talking to some inmates in the library, and he points down to a book cart, you know, full of library books, and the camera pans down, and there, on the top of the stack, huge full-frame glamour shot of Patrick Rothfuss, huge on the cover, Wise Man's Fear, and it's the I believe it's the library binding, so it's like the slightly larger soft cover with the sort of plastic over the cover. And the guard's like, "Oh, I loved the first Kingkiller book. Can I have this one?" Now, it does not sort of serve any like plot advancement. It's just sort of a little character moment. But I was like, some writer on that show must fucking love your book because they wrote it with a verbal name check and a huge glamour shot into the show. Amazing. And then I saw on Twitter, I posted on Twitter and I was like, holy shit. And there were a million questions and all of that. But did you, did you know that was going to happen? And B, what sort of arrangements were in place to have that come about?
Well, it's, I did know that it was coming. I didn't know how it was going to show up. But they, you know, they contacted us and they cleared it. You know, and effectively all they did is said, you know, we're going to name check, you know, one of the books and show a cover. Is that okay with you guys? Which, you know, and I'm not sure if it's a legal issue or if it's a courtesy issue. It's probably a little bit of both is my guess.
Yeah, that's my understanding is like 50-50.
Yeah,
like, because they could probably just get away with doing it, but like why risk it?
Yeah. And, you know, like, you could probably say something, you know, like the publisher, if it wanted to be, you know, you know, really dumb, could do something like, you know, we own the art for the cover of this book. You have used it in something that you are using to make money. That's not fair use of our intellectual property. But the truth is, like, who wouldn't want one of their books to show up on TV.
In a good show too.
In a good show, in a flattering way. It wasn't like, oh, I read this piece of shit and You know, my only complaint is that it wasn't 365 pages long, so I could wipe my ass with it every day of the year.
Yeah, it was pretty good, except what was the whole deal where he goes into the fairy realm? I wasn't into that part. She could have lost that whole plot.
But they did. They asked if it'd be okay. And I said, thank you very much for asking. I'm flattered. Be my guest. I might have signed a paper to that effect. I expect they also... That kind of came through the publisher because, of course, it is the publisher's book, you know, in most legal senses. So I did know it was coming. I certainly, please don't assume that, like, my marketing team managed to insert it or something like that. If there are people that can do that sort of thing, I do not possess them.
We've had this happen with cards a few times. Wise Man's Fear was on what I consider to be the best drama on TV right now, or Netflix or whatever you want to call it now. But we were on Keeping Up with the Kardashians, and we did sign a release for the Kardashians to play Cards Against Humanity on their program. So that's also pretty good. I mean, you know, that's a pretty big deal if I do say so myself. Yeah, best drama on TV, Kardashians playing your game. It could go either way. but anyway, same deal of like they asked us for a release and all that. But the reason I bring that up, congrats. That's extremely cool. And I was just like dumbfounded. It was such a surreal, cool moment to see that in the show. But the reason I bring that up is the other book that got a lot of love in this season was in the finale. One of the characters played by Kate Mulgrew, who is Captain Janeway, the best Star Trek captain, and also has like probably one of my favorite characters on Orange is the New Black. She reads an excerpt from one of my other favorite books called Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott. And it's sort of this wonderful, very, very wonderful book about writing. And what sort of and I was just thinking about Bird by Bird as we were talking about the soap thing, where it was like you were mentioning that you knew what all of your characters smelled like. And, you know, you had these soaps made that matched the sense of your characters. And Anne Lamott has this thing in Bird by Bird where she's like, one way you can tell if a character is really fleshed out is you can ask yourself, what's in a character's pockets? And it should be pretty obvious to you. And I was thinking about this for a lot of books that I love and that I really connect with. And I could say with some certainty of like for books that I really connect with the character, I could sort of tell you what's in their pockets. Like the world is that well established and I understand the character well enough that it makes sense. And one of the books where I was like, I could tell you, I was like, I know what a bunch of characters in Kingkiller, I bet I could say what's in their pockets. Do you, if I asked you like what's in Quoth's pockets right now, I bet you know exactly what's in there.
Yeah. It's pretty easy for me. If for no other reason than quite frequently, I have actually explained in the books what is in his pockets.
Right.
And that's interesting because I know about Bird by Bird. I probably own a copy and I think I was supposed to read it at some point in some writing class, but I'm really bad at reading textbooks or things like nonfiction that I'm supposed to learn from. It's not a good vehicle for knowledge for me.
For what it's worth, it's a pretty charming book in that it's not a bunch of like prescriptive, boring prescriptive or technical advice about writing. It's a lot of sort of like anecdotes about her life and struggles that writers have. And I don't know. It's a lot about the, you know, the way we talk about writing of like the broader struggles and themes about writing and not like, you know, never start a sentence with an infinitive.
Right. I've heard it very highly recommended by a lot of people. And honestly, just that one piece, I think is if that's indicative of the book, then that shows that, yeah, the book is absolutely worthwhile. And the more I think about it, the more I like it because, I haven't done a lot of writing workshops, but there was one that was taught by really solid teachers and pro writers that was attached to a writing contest where I actually got my start as a published writer. And Tim Powers taught that, who's like a great teacher and a great speaker and a great writer who really knows the industry. He's been in for a long time. And he said, you have to know so much more than you say He goes, you gotta, he's like, you gotta know, you don't just need to know what shirt the guy, your character is wearing. You need to know, like, when's the last time he changed his shirt? You know, and, you know, that's a pretty good way of putting it. But I have to say, and you know, with all due deference to Tim, it's way better to say, what does this character have in his or her pockets? Because
you may have taken the shirt thing a little literally.
Right. Yeah, maybe that did have some
planted
have
some sort of seed
bleed through into my books. But the you know, thinking about that, it really is, because you need to know the world, you need to know that person's situation, and you need to know how their mind works to think realistically about what, you know, what might this person have in their pockets. And that's just it. Not what do they have, but what might they have? Because if you know enough about somebody to speculate on them, then you actually have a lot of data. And, you know, think about all the people you know in real life. I'm actually doing this now. I'm like, you know, I can think about my kids. Like, what do they have in their pockets? I know I can make some guesses. You know, I can think about Sarah. I can think about you. Like, what might you have in your pockets? And so, yeah, if you can do that with a character, that's really great.
I read that and I thought that would appeal to you. I was like, this seems like the kind of thing that Pat would know. Now, one other, I just have like a whole list of questions, down this line to ask you. So one of the ones that was interesting to me that I came across was, I was on I made the horrible mistake of going on the King Killer Chronicle subreddit on are you aware of this?
I'm aware there is a thriving community of people that discuss my books in various places on the net.
So the one on Reddit is it's a big, I was trying to look something up about one of the books, and I got linked to a subreddit thread of people talking about it. And now there's a big community of people sort of talking about the books and speculating and I don't know, sharing, you know, King Killer Chronicles tattoos that they get and things like that. And they seem to have a somewhat adversarial relationship with you as the author, in that they seem to be very, they have a lot of expectations. They seem to be pretty entitled to certain, you know, expectations they have about the story and about your writing schedule and things like that. And I found the whole thing to be not in great taste. But I did see a really interesting question that caught my eye in there, which was, and the subject of this thread was, does Patrick Rothfuss understand the Lethani? And the question was, so it's, the Lethani are sort of presented in the books as these people who, you know, like Tempe has been studying the Lethani for his whole life and he doesn't fully understand them. Is that a crutch of like, you don't know it all, or is that the mystique that you're building, but in order to write it, you do have to understand the whole thing? I thought that was an unusually interesting and thoughtful question.
It is an interesting question on a couple of levels. Just the Lethani in general, it's, you know, you could almost say that it's emblematic of my whole writing style, because and this is something that I've slowly come to realize over many years, that the way I write is not the way that a lot of other people write. Both in terms of process and in terms of my execution. Specifically, my writing is a lot more implied, or rather it's implicit, whereas most writing, most fantasy writing is very explicit. You know, Tolkien says, here's the Shire, here's what happens, here's an appendix, here's the history. Whereas it's more that I show people moving through a world, or I show people talking about a world. And so you get a lot of things that you can kind of piece together on your own, but, you know, and again, that's a deep rabbit hole, and I don't necessarily want to go all the way down it right now, but, there are a lot of things in the world that defy direct explication. As a matter of fact, most of the more interesting things in the world, in my opinion, are those that defy direct explication. You know, concepts, you know, like liberty. There's a reason why people debate these philosophic concepts and say, what is truth? What is beauty? You can't really hold up, you know, 3 pounds of beauty, you know, and say, here's where it is. That's why this is more beautiful than that. This has 4 ounces of beauty. That has 2.5. And, you know, it gets even more complicated when you start, again, a lot of Eastern philosophies and religions brush up against this stuff of the concept of nirvana, the thing that people strive to achieve enlightenment. And you get the whole tradition of Zen koans, or these stories that are designed to bring into people's awareness truths which cannot be explained. And so, yeah, it's interesting. I've wandered very far afield from this question, just because, you know, it's like, do I understand the Lathani? I think it's more an interesting question for them to debate than it is for me to answer.
Well, and maybe what made me interested about that question is like, well, if you leave aside the genre fiction elements of your writing, right, and you were to say about any other, you know, does Tolstoy, you know, whatever, you know, like take a Tolstoy novel, right? Does Tolstoy understand humans, right? Why is he writing with such subtext about humans? Does he really understand their culture?
That's an interesting way to take it in that direction. You could almost say, you pull the horror elements out of Stephen King and you say, does Stephen King truly understand the dynamics of small town America?
Right. And well, and you can't, and that point is that you can't. I mean, it would be ridiculous to say that such a thing was understandable, because that's not how society works.
Yeah.
Do not feel like you need to respond to this. I don't want to get you in any beef or anything, but I read a very interesting critique of the author Orson Scott Card's writing the other day. And you know, so I read Ender's Game at the just the right tender age where I was like, I think I was in sixth grade, and I was in that phase where I was like smarter than other kids in my class, and I was getting bullied. And I read this story about, you know, Ender, who's this kid who's smarter than everyone else, and he outwits everyone, and he saves the day. And I was like, yes, this is the book. Like this, I relate to this, and you know, it speaks to me very directly. And it was one of my favorite books for a long time, and it has not aged well. Like as I get older and I revisited Ender's Game, like I think there's some cool sci-fi concepts happening, and there's some characters that have stuck with me, but I by and large I don't think it's a good book, and I philosophically am not really into it. And I read a great sort of critique of the writing of it. So not leaving aside the themes and the politics of it, it was just a critique of the writing. And someone was like, one of the reasons they suspect, the author of this article was like, one of the reasons that they suspect Orson Scott Card has been so an enduring favorite among, you know, like middle school age boys and sci-fi fans, is that he understands people in a kind of an autistic way, in that his writing demonstrates almost zero empathy for the interior condition of other people. And he directly states how people, and especially women, feel. So he will say, Petra felt scared. Right, he puts a label and he quantifies all of the behavior and all of the actions and everyone according to these very tidy systems, so that it's very logically. So when you're in that, you know, and I mean not to oversimplify, but when you're that like middle school age boy, like I'm gonna get myself in trouble here. When you're a middle school boy, you have low empathy for the people around you. That muscle is not developed yet. And it is very tempting to look at people as these like rational actors in the system. This is where kid, you know, young men read like Ayn Rand and they're like, this appeals to me because like, yes, the smartest, best people should rise to the top, you know? So anyway, it just made me it was realizing that it was like, you know, that's why this book appealed to me when I was 12. And as a 29-year-old, I don't get as much out of it because I read this book and I'm like, this really does not reveal that much that's enduring about human nature to me. There's not much subtext in that book. And when I read your books, I'm left with many interesting questions to think about people and my society and the characters in your books where there is subtext and the emotions are not directly spelled out. And I wonder if that's, you know, I know, you know, some of the other fan reaction I've seen to like a character like Denna, where, you know, as the reader, you're asking the reader to do a lot of work to understand what's going on with Denna's character.
One of the things I specifically didn't bring up when I'm like, you know, I could talk about this element of writing for a week, you know, before I felt the need to sit down or even take a breath. But one of the things I was going to mention specifically was something I avoid. And it's probably that I started out doing it just because it came naturally to me, but now I do it very intentionally and deliberately, is I don't, you know, and in this book in particular, you are seeing the vast majority of the action through Kvothe's eyes. So you only really see what he sees. And you get to know what he thinks. And so Kvothe might think, boy, she seems angry, but you don't know that she is angry, which is actually a huge difference.
You as the author are not swooping in to label and quantify the emotional state of all characters in the book.
Exactly. And more importantly, I'm actually trying to specifically avoid it, because you could do, like, on the far end is what you've just described, is saying something like, you know, she felt angry, you know, coming in as like an omnipotent third person narrator saying, you know, she was angry. If you take a step, you know, a step back from that, or a step, you know, along the spectrum, you could say, you know, well, I don't like meatloaf, she said angrily. Now, that implies that the tone of her voice was angry, but also it's pretty much just saying it. It's saying that she's saying it angrily. So it's pretty much pushing that on you. Whereas I don't do that. I don't say, I might say that they shouted. I might say that their voice was rough. I might say that they frowned, or that somebody leaned forward over the table, or that they pounded on the table. But the truth is, when you're in the real world and you're having a conversation with somebody, you read like a myriad of tiny social cues. And then a lot of those read, and they read pretty fairly and pretty truly, so that you know how a person thinks or feels. You know, maybe to like 85% accuracy, right? Somebody scowls, somebody shouts, somebody bangs on a table. Those are pretty clear. But still, I don't want to tell you, you know, I don't want to fall into the trap of people thinking they know what other people think, because you don't. And part of that is a philosophical standpoint I have, because I think that that's kind of dangerous behavior to encourage, that you can absolutely know what's going on in other people's heads. But also it's a narrative technique that I use specifically with the intention to draw the reader in and to make the reader do work so that they emotionally and intellectually engage with the character and the story that's happening.
To me, I would say I don't know what to call this, to put like a label on this, but this factor that we're kind of like talking about right now, this is when people talk about a difference between literary fiction and genre fiction. To me, this would be one of the defining differences.
Oh, interesting.
Literary fiction is very much about the thing we're talking about, right? It's about these people's stories, building empathy, trying to use story as a way to think about people and think about relationships and think about society and things like that. And genre fiction is, I think it can serve a variety of different purposes, but usually it's I don't know, it's more of like mathematical, of like just trying to like understand all the secrets of this world and you know, understand all the cool action that happens in it or something like that. But there's something really interesting happening. I think there's like a new wave of like genre fiction books that are getting me really excited about the current state of genre fiction, where it's like all about this stuff.
The truth is, and it's not really a secret, it's something that most everybody, I think anybody who thinks about it very much has already figured out. It's, you know, we're kind of excited because of the plot, you know, because of things happening, you know, we're interested because of plot, but we care because of characters, you know? And you know, it's just kind of as simple as that. But, the other thing that's happening is you're saying it's kind of a new thing in fantasy, and it is. It's not a unique thing. It's not the first time this has started to happen. But, you know, truthfully, fantasy as a discrete genre is super, super young. And, you know, you could argue about where it really started. But it's probably, there are worse places to plant your flag than with the publication of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. You know, that's a fair place to point and say fantasy started there. Now, you can quibble and you can bicker, and with justification, right? There was Gargantuan and Pantagruel, you know, or hell, you could go, you could point at really every good play of Shakespeare's you could probably claim for fantasy, because Midsummer Night's Dream is full of fairies and Hamlet has a ghost and so does Macbeth, you know, plus witches and prophecy. You know, or the Odyssey, go all the way back to the Odyssey. If that isn't a fantasy novel, I don't know what is. but realistically, again, as a genre, you know, we kind of started with Tolkien, which means we started, you know, I'm going to shame myself here. When did those come out?
Wikipedia will tell us. I'm looking it up 50s? Right now. Here we go. 1937.
37's The Hobbit. When's The Lord of the Rings?
Wait. Published 1954.
I was right. 54. Yeah. And Lord of the Rings came out.
Yeah. No. The Lord of the Rings is 54.
Okay.
The Hobbit is 37.
Okay. Yeah, look at the gap in those stories and then bitch to me about book three. but you know, he kind of was a huge formative influence, and I'm not saying that there weren't people before him, because there absolutely were. But, you know, the genre kind of coalesced around him. You know, and against some of these other speculative fiction. But before then, it was kind of pulp and sci-fi and, you know, and all these things. But again, so as, you know, as fantasy right now, it means we've kind of existed for, gosh, you know, 60-ish, you know, 70-ish years. That's super new for a genre. And if you go back to look at when other genres were emerging, you know, go all the way back to Greece, you know, which you and I have kind of a fondness for. You had theater, you know, kind of coming into existence as like a codified, you know, a genre that was existing and developing, and in some ways kind of a new way. And so people came in and they said, well, you know, it's a tragedy. And what makes it a tragedy? Well, you have a hero with a flaw and he falls from a great height. And so they go, oh, so a king, right? Because if he's going to fall from a great height, you've got to, you know, you got to be a king because that's the biggest height you can fall from. And then slowly, you know, and I don't like the term literary fiction just because it's really muddy, but you get this classical assumption that, yeah, a hero has to be a dude and it has to be a king. And if it's a true tragedy, then it's got to be a king. I'm going all the way back to like Sophocles here. Like, and so Sophocles, you know, because it was Sophocles that did Oedipus Rex, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And so you have Oedipus Rex and he's got fall full of hubris and, you know, and Oedipus, you know, was a king and Oedipus did all sorts of, he made bad choices, but, and so he falls from this great height and, but, and then eventually, you know, and, you know, Aristotle comes in and goes, yep, theater. Here's the rules. Here's the Aristotelian unities. And everyone's like, oh, okay, shit. Yeah, okay, let's do it. But then eventually what happens as a genre matures is people go, well, wait, hold on. What are we trying to do? Why do we have these rules? What's the purpose of these rules? And then people realize, you know, and again, you make your own graph, but people realize that, no, it doesn't actually have to be a king. Because you can fall from a great height emotionally. You can fall from a great height socially. You can fall, you know, psychologically or, you know, economically or just situationally. And eventually a genre matures and they're like, maybe we don't need to have, you know, an entire kingdom hanging in the balance, that you realize that, like, a woman in a cottage at night and it's dark and there's something moving through the dark outside is as emotionally engaging as 100 fucking Greek kings. You know, and similarly, fantasy started, again, with Tolkien. You got Tolkien, you got apocalypse, you got the world ending, ultimate evil, armies clashing, the fate of nations, and everyone's like, holy shit, this is awesome, and it's big, and it's, you know, it's thunderous. But now, you know, and so for a long time, all fantasy was clashing nations and goblin armies and orcs and death and, you know, kings and whatever. But then eventually somebody's like, you know, hey, what if there was just a guy? You know, what if this was all about the characters? What if it's, you know, what if we can get all that drama, but we don't need 1,000 people to die? You know, and so again, I view it as a sign of the maturing of the fantasy genre. You know, and it started in some ways. You could actually point, and again, it's wrong. And it's reductionist to point at any one particular work. But if you were looking for a place, there's a lot to be said for looking at Tad Williams' Dragonbone Chair. You know, that was a very personal, character-centered fantasy that a lot of authors point to. And they say, you know, George Martin said, I read that book and I realized what the fantasy genre could do.
Is that worth the read?
You know, I will say yes. If you enjoy classic fantasy, yes.
What if I still haven't read The Last Unicorn?
Oh, then you got to read The Last Unicorn first.
Okay.
You know, like above any other freaking book, it's gorgeous.
Okay.
The only reason I'm not saying yes, go out and read The Dragonbone Chair is because I read it. I loved it. I read it and thought to myself, literally, I thought, oh, because I read that when I was about 2 years into working on the book that would eventually become The Name of the Wind. And I'm like, what am I doing? Why am I not writing a fantasy like every other fantasy novel I've ever read? you know, who's going to care? Oh, my book is too long. And then Dragon Bone Chair came out and I read it and I'm like, holy shit, this is a huge long novel. And the focus is absolutely on character and drama and all of these things. And yes, there's big events happening as well, but they're background. They're not the whole point of everything. So yeah, it's a foundational book in fantasy literature, but I also have to say I have not read it in 15 years. And so I don't know how I would feel about it these days in comparison to some other newer things that are happening. But yeah, it holds a very special place in my heart. And it was instrumental in helping to change the genre.